Greetings and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm your host, Monica Black. And as you know, our job at New Books in History is to pick out exciting new history books that the world needs to know about and interview their authors. And today we have, or I have, the distinct pleasure of interviewing my colleague, Eric Courlander, who teaches history at Stetson University. Eric has just published a really extraordinary new book called Hitler's Monsters, A Supernatural History of the Third Reich. It was published by Yale very recently, this year, 2017. The idea, of course, that there is some spooky supernatural connection between Nazism and the occult has a lengthy history, a history that in fact predates 1933, when the National Socialist Party took power in Germany. But what's behind that idea? Where did that idea come from? Some top-ranking members of the Nazi Party were deeply engaged with the occult, especially and perhaps most famously Heinrich Himmler. So was Nazi occultism just some weird novelty? Well, Eric Courlander will talk to us in just a moment, and he's going to tell us that no, it wasn't. It was in fact something that suffused the whole project of the Third Reich in many ways. So I hope that are you over there, Eric? Can you hear me?
I am, Monica. Thank you so much for inviting me on the show.
It's my pleasure. It's absolutely my distinct pleasure to talk to you. It's always my pleasure to talk to you, and particularly now that you've published this really kind of doorstop book, an amazingly deeply researched book. Let's start out maybe by why don't you talk to us a little bit about your own kind of biographical path or your sort of career path and how it led you to this topic in particular?
Sure. Thank you. It's a very good question, and I thought about it a lot while I was in the early stages of the research. I think I've been interested in German history and Holocaust history from my undergraduate days. But when I went to graduate school, as you know, we're pretty much the same generation, it was at the height of the kind of post-Sonderweg revisionist critique, right? So the idea was we wanted to, if not normalize German history, put German history back in a wider European context, see it as quintessentially modern, not try to find the areas where it may have diverged from the rest of European history or British history or French history. And so my initial foray into the archives looking for questions was not to follow this, which is one of the many things I was interested in, which was the supernatural or kind of occult or mythological traditions in German history, but to look for something that was more of a direct intervention into the post-Sonderweg zeitgeist. And I hit on German liberalism and why it was so successful in some ways, but unsuccessful in others. And my first two books deal in different ways with German liberalism. But once I kind of established those interventions after 8 to 10 years of being a working faculty member, I came back to this and I thought, you know, I always did want to explore these ideas of what kind of history, what is the real history of the Nazi supernatural, the occult. And a number of good books had come out in the 90s and early 2000s, which helped inspire me, including my colleague, Corinna Tritel, who did a book on occultism in general, Science of the Soul, in Germany from the late 19th century through the Third Reich. I thought, you know, this is a legitimate area of inquiry. It's time that maybe someone took a more, a broader, more holistic approach rather than looking at different aspects of religion or paganism or esotericism. And I tried to formulate an approach that would allow me to look at the supernatural writ large.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very interesting story that you just told. And there is certainly a generational aspect of this that at a certain moment, as German historians, there were, I think, topics that seemed to fit an older set of stereotypes about German history, and people really wanted to get away from those stereotypes, and rightfully so. On the other hand, of course, as you point out, there's an enormous amount to know about the occult in Germany before and during the Third Reich and also after it. And a lot of it has very interesting intersections with the history of science and the history of religion, as you and I have both, you know, learned over the years. So one of the key, it seems to me, concepts of your book is what you call the supernatural imaginary. Can you kind of talk to us about what that, what you mean by that, and how that concept, the supernatural imaginary, works in your book?
Definitely. And actually, I want to follow up on something you just mentioned, which ties into this historiographical context. All the really good work since the mid to late 90s on science, religion, and the occult, the one commonality is it tends to just assume a German modernity, which is not that dissimilar from a British, French, or European-wide modernity. So while we accept that all of these things are really interesting, as you just said, and important, they don't necessarily speak to why Austria and Germany had a strong and ultimately successful fascist party and regime, the Third Reich. And I think that's where my work does diverge a bit from this revisionist trend and saying, well, there is a more particular history there. So I just wanted to follow up on that and say, in many ways, I'm following the revisionist trend, but in other ways, by accepting the modernity of Germany and the diversity of all these different groups and ideas and doctrines. But I do think there's something specific to the Central European space. And so then to come to, does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. No, I'm glad you inserted that clarification because I think it's really important.
So the supernatural imaginary, it took some time. I'd already done the research. I'd done quite a bit of primary source research and secondary reading, trying to come up with what it was as a unifying kind of concept that explained the ways of thinking, the kind of epistemology, modes of inquiry that I kept seeing that united what I meant by supernatural. And occultism didn't work, right? Occultism was too specific.
Right.
Ideology wasn't what I was looking at. There was no coherent ideology. It wasn't a religion. And culture was just too broad.
Mm-hmm.
Culture can have a lot of different subcultures or competing discourses or what have you. And I actually came across a book by the philosopher Charles Taylor, which was basically an investigation of what he called the social imaginary, and how the social imaginary comes to inform the way people think about their identity in civil society, their political beliefs. And I thought, you know, his definition of an imaginary as a kind of a set of widely held assumptions and ways of thinking about the world that's not as coherent as an ideology but is more specific than culture,
mm-hmm.
that would work if I just replace social with supernatural. This idea that there are all these different doctrines, ideas, modes of inquiry, epistemologies floating around that are supernatural in provenance, and people imagine their own worlds, both in everyday life and broader political and social, even kind of religious terms, through that supernatural lens. Maybe that's what I'm looking for, a supernatural imaginary. Is that clear enough?
Yeah, no, I think that's wonderful. I hope that'll be clear for people outside of the field. I mean, maybe let's talk about it just a little bit further. When you think about this supernatural imaginary, you're essentially thinking about something that captures all of the variety of ways that people thought about the world and the cosmos in the Third Reich.
Right. Well, and before the Third Reich.
And before the
Third
Reich.
Part of the argument of the book is that the supernatural, you could argue that all societies have a kind of supernatural imaginary, but sometimes it's very privatized and doesn't find expression in public life, certainly not in social, political, foreign policy terms. In other cases, it's tied very much and informed by traditional religion. It could be evangelical Christianity or fundamentalist Islam. And that's what fills in that supernatural imaginary. And then you get moments in time like Central Europe in the 1890s to the 1930s, where there's a whole range of alternative religions and doctrines and border sciences and occult ideas that have much in common with each other, but are really in other ways distinct and based on supernatural, kind of a supernatural epistemology. And that's, so yes, I'm talking about all of those things together. The supernatural imaginary, the content of that will change, but I think all societies have that in some ways.
So how does it, tell us how it worked in the formation of Nazism, and then tell us a little bit about, because the first chapters of your book are indeed about the period before 1933. So tell us about how the supernatural imaginary informs the kind of foundations of Nazism as a political ideology, and then maybe carry us through a little bit into the Third Reich itself and the way that the supernatural imaginary informed or formed the basis of, in some ways, the Nazi project, you know, sort of writ large.
Okay. Well, that's a big question.
It is a big question.
I'll try to break it down as clearly as I can. So the way I try to clarify all these different elements, or at least distinguish them among them, is by saying that you have the religion, you have a kind of religious tradition in the 19th century that's alternative to mainstream Christianity. Sometimes it's informed by Christianity. Sometimes it's completely pagan. And I look at a cluster of these different religious traditions that developed in the 19th century as an alternative to mainstream Christianity under the rubric of Ario-Germanic religion, mm-hmm. right? That's one of the three main pillars of what I call this emerging supernatural imaginary that by the eve of World War I is fairly well developed.
Mm-hmm.
So Ario-Germanic religion. The other element is what I call border science, which is, it's a fancy way of saying, but popular already at the time, occult science, or sciences that are based on what in the Middle Ages would have been called occult or esoteric beliefs, but by the late 19th century have been systematized and given a kind of scientific sheen, so to speak. So parapsychology, right, which is really the study of, and in some ways belief in, the ability to manipulate things with your mind, clairvoyance, levitation, spiritualism. But parapsychology had become a kind of discipline where you study those phenomena as if they might really exist, mm-hmm. right? That's a border science. Astrology or cosmobiology, which is a related form of astrology, the idea that you can glean scientifically from the stars, the cosmos, the planets, certain patterns in human life, certain insights into the natural world, world ice theory, which I talk about in various chapters, this idea that the world and the universe were actually created by giant blocks of ice floating around in the cosmos, and when they melted, crashed into each other, crashed into the Earth, that caused most of the natural history of our planet. These are what I would call border sciences, and you can see that while they are at their root faith-based and supernatural in many ways, they masquerade, they operate as if they are natural sciences, at least the people who practice them would say that, mm-hmm. right? And then you have the kind of traditional occult, which would be these doctrines like Ariosophy, Anthroposophy, Theosophy, doctrines that claim to have gleaned deeper truths about the world, about everything from, you know, a possible spiritual insight into, you know, your own personality, to a larger religious truth, to evolution, to racial science, and they combine all these things together. So there's elements of religion and there's elements of border science in these occult doctrines. So by the eve of World War I, by 1914, you've got these three pillars, or these three kind of separate traditions, Aryo-Germanic religious traditions, border science, and kind of mainstream occultism, which have all become really popular in much of Germany and Austria, especially in the cities, right? Though there are folk beliefs and practices also in the countryside. And this is the era, the 1890s to World War I, when most of the people who will join the Nazi Party are coming of age. So the whole point of my first chapter is to set this up and say, look, this wasn't some marginal culture or subculture. These are becoming very important ways of viewing the world, right? Mm-hmm. I have colleagues who have done, you know, studies of anthroposophy per se, or of some of these religious beliefs and, you know, monographic work, but this is widespread. Millions are interested in these things. And then you get the war, right? And all of these ideas, which are percolating, start to become, I would argue, more politicized, more tied to existential questions about life and death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So you have this generation who've sort of been nourished on these ideas. And I think also, and you bring this out in the book in various ways, nourished on these ideas in various combinations, because different people are interested in different things. And then they sort of come of age in this moment when Germany has suffered a totally unexpected and catastrophic defeat in the First World War. So what's the next step after that?
Right. So there's nothing inherently fascist in the 19-teens, in the early 20th century, about these ideas. But there are many elements which will become, which will help facilitate National Socialism and other folkish right-wing subcultures in the 20s. So, for example, if you look at some of these occult Masonic groups like the Ariosophists, they believe in a lost Atlantean or Thulean civilization of kind of first men who were racially superior, possibly after mating with aliens at some point, whose civilization collapsed either because a giant block of ice hit the earth. Well, that ties into the border science of world ice theory, or there was a major flood, or because of their racial degeneracy. They started intermingling with lesser races, which is a trope in many of these occult doctrines, Theosophy, Madame Blavatsky, as well as Steiner's Anthroposophy. And all of these ideas are intermingling with the folkish politicians who are fascinated by Ariosophy, this Aryan form of occultism. And those groups during the war become more and more politicized. So instead of meeting in, you know, their drawing rooms and talking about their new dowsing technique, or trying to reconstruct ancient Germanic runes or cast spells or what have you, mm-hmm. they're starting to organize and say, hey, you know, the Jews are exploiting the war to make money, and they're undermining the war effort, or the socialists can't be trusted, or, you know, look what's happening with women and sexuality and the degeneracy of what's going on during the war. And one of these groups, the German Order, creates his own political wing during the war, called the Hammer Association. It's led by a notorious anti-Semite named Theodor Fritsch. Mm-hmm. And as his groups kind of splinter off, one of these chapters of the German Order in Munich is looking for new leadership, and it finds this guy named Rudolf von Zaboltendorf, who happens to also be an occultist as well as a racialist folkish thinker. And Zaboltendorf is charged with resuscitating the German Order, this occult Masonic group, in Munich. And he finds a gentleman named Walter Nauhaus, a failed artist, young guy, wounded at the front, who's mulling around his future in Munich, who had his own group that he had formed called the Thule Gesellschaft, the Thule Society, linking back to this idea of an Atlantean Ur-Aryan civilization. And Zaboltendorf said, look, the German Order is kind of defunct. Why don't we name our new organization? Why don't we take over that name, the Thule Gesellschaft, for our organization? This is in summer of 1918. the war's going badly. They're still conducting dowsing experiments and talking about astrology. And in fact, Sabodnarf will become the editor of one of the big astrological journals in Germany in the 20s. So they're still very closely tied together here. But when the war ends and there's a socialist revolution in Bavaria, Sabodnarf and his colleagues become radicalized and are talking all the time now about how we have to get rid of Judah and the communist Jewish Bolshevik menace, and we need some kind of social and national program that unites workers and bourgeoisie, you know, anyone who thinks in a national way. And they use this term, social national, national social. And sure enough, within a few weeks of the war ending, two members of the Thule Society, Karl Harrer and Anton Drexler, who many lay historians would know as one of the co-founders of the Nazi Party, they get together and form a workers' circle to attract workers to this new movement. And then in January 1919, the German Workers' Party, Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, which will become the National Socialist German Workers' Party. So the Nazi Party comes directly out of this milieu. We can talk for how it also in some ways breaks away from that milieu. But you see how this wider milieu that I described in the late 19th, early 20th century comes together in this small, very personal way with these few individuals who then create the platform for the Nazi Party. And I'll leave it at that.
Right. So the party is literally born in this sort of complex of supernatural and occult and border scientific ideas.
Yeah.
Then, talk about that. Talk about the next step, which you just alluded to a moment ago. To what extent does the party early on remain enamored of these ideas, and to what extent do some members of the party begin to pull away from them? How does all of that sort itself out?
Great question. Because not every early member of the German Workers' Party had been an occultist or in an occult Masonic group or even necessarily fascinated by a specific border scientific doctrine. But they were attracted to the party, like many of these right-wing parties after the war, because they thought it would get rid of the shame of the Versailles Treaty and kick out the Jewish and socialist leaders of the new republic. However, if you look at the list of the early of the Thule Society members, or at least those who would come to meetings well before Hitler ever got involved, they include Dietrich Eckart, who is also considered one of the most important early leaders of the Nazi Party, Gottfried Feder, the economic specialist of the Nazi Party, both of whom, by the way, Eckart and Feder are mentors to Hitler. You've got Hans Frank, the lawyer for the Nazi Party, eventually the notorious governor of the government general in Poland during the war. He helped facilitate the Holocaust. He's hanging out there. Rudolf Hess, who has his own esoteric proclivities, is going to Thule Society meetings as a student in Munich. We've already named four of the most important leaders of the Nazi Party at that time. Alfred Rosenberg went to a few meetings. So it's not as if you have these obscure people who create a party and years later some Nazis appropriate it. They're there at the beginning. Hitler isn't there not because of his hostility to occultism. He hasn't come to any meetings yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's nine more months until right. September, when he goes to a German Workers' Party meeting and gets recruited by Eckart and Feder to join them. So at the beginning already, you've got leading Nazis. Now the question is, why does the party, the German Workers' Party, eventually National Socialist German Workers' Party, not embrace as directly the occult traditions of the Thule Society? That is, they're not meeting at the same time that they're talking about having a putsch attempt against the local government and talking about astrology and dowsing. We don't have a record of that. I have a number of observations I'd make there. One, the big problem with both the occult movement that I have outlined and the Focus movement that everyone agrees helped create the Nazi Party, both of those movements, which were very much intertwined at times, were heavily bourgeois, elitist, had all sorts of rules and regulations, not only about race, but about membership dues and dress, and would meet in the fancy hotel like the Four Seasons. That's where the Thule Society met. And it just was not a way of attracting a mass political following, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hitler recognized this. And he associated, in some ways, the more doctrinaire occult traditions, people wandering, or fascination with people wandering around in bearskins, as he put it, with alienating the average worker or voter who didn't get all this esoteric stuff, who didn't read Germanic runes, right?
Right.
So he took the swastika, he took the Ariosophic thinking about race, and, you know, trying to return to this pure ancient super race. He took a lot of other ideas, or other Nazis took them, but they wanted to break away from this kind of bourgeois elitist occult milieu out of which the party initially emerged. And much of what you see between 1920 and 24 is trying to negotiate that, keeping the good bits that are good for propaganda, keeping the swastika and other traditions, but eliminating the more obscure aspects.
Right,
that would alienate a mass following.
Keeping some of those things that resonated on some mythological level or some, you know, emotional level, and kicking out the ones that might be alienating it, when you're trying to create a mass party, which in fact the party became. So now tell us then, just sort of skipping ahead a little bit, what is the role that border sciences and various kinds of esotericism and the supernatural imaginary, and more generally, what is the role that these things played in the project of creating a new Germany after 1933?
Excellent. Yeah, well, good question. And just let me, with a prelude to that, say that when it came to achieving power in the late 20s and early 30s, the Nazis very consciously drew on these occult and border scientific and pagan religious traditions. I talk about three prominent examples of this. Hitler reading a parapsychologist and sexologist called Ernst Schertl, who wrote a book on magic. And it was in Hitler's library, annotated in handwriting that looks to be his own. It mm-hmm. was dedicated to the Führer. It was sent to him personally. And there were 66 passages he had highlighted about how you can use your kind of inner esoteric energies that go back to the beginnings of humanity to manipulate people and their psychology. So and that's not the only case of that. I'm giving a prominent one, or the fact that Hans Heinz Evers, who was the most famous horror writer in the 1920s and 30s in Germany, the Stephen King of his time, right?
That's right.
Was commissioned by Goebbels to write propaganda material for the Nazis, including two very famous books. That hundreds of thousands of people read about the stormtrooper movement, which also had a lot of occultists in it, by the way, which is mm-hmm. interesting. And Horst Wessel, who became the kind of martyr. They had a song dedicated to Horst Wessel. And then finally, the clairvoyant Erich Hanussen, who was actually Jewish, though he denied it, and there were always rumors he's really Jewish. He was best friends with a lot of stormtroopers and helped promote the Nazi party in his magazines and his performances by saying, Hitler's going to come save us, and the Nazi party in 1932, that's going to be the Nazis' year. So they started allying with these forces already before 33.
Mm-hmm.
After 33, they did, and so without getting too much into the weeds here, there were attempts by some Nazi leaders to try to suppress certain occult groups or doctrines. The argument I make is they did that as part of a general process of reining in what they called sectarianism, meaning any kind of alternative religious belief, any kind of secret society. That's why they didn't like Jehovah's Witnesses, but didn't have a problem with Lutherans, right? Because Lutherans are a large group, mainstream. They're out in the open. Jehovah's Witnesses have their own, in their mind, odd practices and you know, aren't willing to be full citizens or fight for the army. So it wasn't that they were anti-occultists per se, I argue. It's that occultists, like many other sectarian groups, were not buying in immediately in their minds to National Socialism. The ones who did quite well. And that gets to the question you just asked. I look at kind of two different strains of this supernatural imaginary. The border sciences, right? Mm-hmm. On the one hand, things like astrology, parapsychology, world ice theory, and then Aryo-Germanic paganism or religion on the other. And we could get into details in both. Suffice to say that you have plenty of evidence the Nazis found many affinities for these different traditions during the Third Reich and even applications thereof.
Yeah, that's right. So one of the things that I found really, maybe you could talk, you said a moment ago, whether or not we want to get into too many specifics. One thing I think is really interesting, it's all really interesting, but one thing I think is really compelling that maybe listeners would like to know more about just now, before they've had a chance to read the book for themselves. Let's talk a little bit about, in a little bit of detail now, about the connection between, so now we're still talking about sort of the foundation of the Third Reich and the role that the supernatural imaginary played in the project of Nazism as a system of power, as a state. Talk a little bit about the eugenics and race science and the overlaps between that and, which of course, you know, it's complicated because for us, eugenics is already something like border science, although we wouldn't call it that. People would generally tend to call it now pseudoscience, even though it was conducted by people at the highest level of science, not only in Germany, certainly, but in the United States and other places. But there is you have some very interesting ways of talking about the overlap between the supernatural imaginary and racial science. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And that, you know, was really during the war where that became the most pronounced, but it's linked to traditions that go back to the 20s and 30s. Namely, so first of all, I did differentiate between what I call border science and pseudoscience. Pseudoscience is just bad science masquerading as science, right? It's not provable. The methodology is flawed, and yet people are claiming their results are accurate. And eugenics is, in many respects, a pseudoscience. Eugenics is also, in some respects, an exaggerated form of biology or genetics, right? That it's based on some real science, but they go too far or they draw conclusions that are not provable. Border science, which comes out of occultism and faith-based doctrines, is not pseudoscience it's not merely pseudoscience because for the people practicing it, they really thought they had an alternative way of understanding reality, that there is something supernatural out there from the perspective of natural science, and those natural scientists don't have the energy or methods to figure that out. So border scientists can. And when you approach race from a border scientific perspective, anything is possible. So as bad as eugenics is, right, eugenics has limits, as we saw in Britain and America and Sweden. Those experiments often failed, right? They never became policy, or they rarely became policy, because at some point enough biologists and anthropologists would push back and say, look, how do you know this isn't nurture? Or what are the results? Or how do you know that this would actually work? And people working in eugenics were kind of hemmed in by the authority of other mainstream scientists. In the Third Reich, nothing's to stop you when you claim that the Aryans are a super race whose, you know, earliest leaders were in the Thule or the Atlantean civilization. And then after the flood, they went to Tibet, and that's where the race and religion's been preserved, which is one of the beliefs that's widely popular in folkish and later Nazi circles. Why can't you also say at the same time that the Jews have always been a kind of demonic, vampiric, super race or superhuman, monstrous race, even if it's clear many Jews by any genetic or biological criteria are mixed, are just a racially diverse group of people who, you know, were German, Slavic, Semitic. The Nazis can get away from all of that complexity and simply say, the Jews are this kind of evil superhuman race that's always been trying to destroy the pure Aryan race. Oh, and by the way, this pure Aryan race, which is obviously Indo-Aryan, includes many people from India, Persia, Japan, which is why we have this great alliance with our Japanese brothers. It has no basis in scientific reality. It's not just pseudoscience. It's really a faith-based border science that borders on religion, right? And that allows one to get away with all sorts of other solutions to the problem. I'll stop there and let you decide what you want to pick up on. But that's
Well, you know, it's just, I mean, there are so many different things to talk about here, but I think we've talked for quite a while at this point. I wonder if one thing that people might be interested to know more about are your sources, because they are truly fascinating. I mean, the source you talked about a moment ago, the book that had been annotated by Hitler that was in his personal library, which I believe was seized at the end of the Second World War and is deposited in some archive in the United States somewhere, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's in the Library of Congress.
Yeah, in the Library of Congress. That's exactly right. With his whole collection of books. Isn't that right? But or at least the ones that were seized from a particular location. But so I wonder if you would talk for a minute about this, about your sources and your research, the conducting of the research, because I think a lot of people will be interested to know what kinds of sources you used. Was this a deep archival dive? Was it both a deep archival dive and then also the result of work that you did in many libraries?
Right. It turned out to be much more of an archival work than I had set out to produce. I thought I'll find some really interesting things in the archives, but I'll also be looking at a lot of published primary material and relying on a lot of secondary works, monographs, dissertations in German that hadn't gotten a lot of attention, and just kind of bringing this all together in a synthesis, say, well, what is the history of the supernatural in the Third Reich? Is there anything there? When I went into the archives and started to find hundreds of pages of leading SS and SD men, including Heydrich, Himmler, Artur Neba, the leading, you know, operators in the Third Reich, Goebbels with astrology and his Nostradamus prophecies, Himmler and Heydrich debating to what degree scientific astrology should be a legitimate form of inquiry and reminding people not to prosecute occultists who are doing it scientifically, all sorts of investigations into the most obscure occult groups, sometimes to prosecute them, other times to recruit them to conduct border scientific experiments under the, in one case, with the protection of Hitler's own chancellery. This guy, Werner Kittler, who worked with Goebbels, was recruiting cosmobiologists and dowsers. All of this is from primary sources that maybe in some cases other people had looked at, but they hadn't pursued in great detail or cross-referenced with, you know, other SS files. So you're finding all of this, and then when you find something by Karl Maria Villigut, who was the religious czar for the SS and a devout Aryasothic occultist, talking about graves and runes, something you would know a lot about, and what to put on in cemeteries, and you realize that all these things are linked, that his belief that he was a descendant of Thor and his desire to make the Wavelsburg Castle into this kind of religious center of Nazism had parallels with their interest in border science, astrology, and other divisions of the SS on an Erba scientific institute, which I called in great detail. I would argue, as you can probably see from this conversation, there are a lot of other stories to tell that I didn't include in the book because they would be getting the details about doctrines or divisions. I mean, Himmler created, based on his Indo-Aryan, also from the archives, Indo-Aryan theories about the Tibetan, the links to Tibet and Central Asia of the Aryan race, created divisions of a Turkmenistan division on the Waffen SS, thinking, well, they must be Aryan in some way. I mean, all of this stuff came out of archival sources in the Federal Archives of Germany or the Institute for Zeitgeschichte, the Institute of Contemporary History in Munich. And there's a lot more there, I would argue.
It must have been an amazing experience as a historian, especially for those of us who, you know, once you're a faculty member and you really don't have a lot of time to do deep archival work. I mean, you get to go for a month maybe in the summer if you're lucky, you know, a few weeks here and there every year. And if you're really lucky and you have a grant, you could go for a year, right? But that's a complicated thing once you're teaching and you have service duties, and you have always had a lot of service duties at your institution, actually, having been your department head for a while. And so it must have been kind of both exciting but also daunting to learn how much material there was. But also, it must have been gratifying in a way to realize that this thing that you had a really strong intuition about was everywhere. It wasn't just something that was somewhere, a little bit here and there. It was everywhere.
Yeah, and in the strangest places, as you found in that the archive for East German folklore, was it?
Yeah, exactly. Amazing thing.
Freiburg, the Karasik archive.
Yeah, in Freiburg. I mean, you know, which is a lovely archive because, unlike almost every other place I ever worked, there's a room, and the very kind people there say, "There you go. There's a desk. Enjoy." And you're allowed to sort of pick things down off the shelves and look at them. And you and I both worked there and found extraordinary things that I don't know. Other people have used these things, and I know who some of those people are, but they've used them for very different things than the things that you and I have looked at them to learn about.
Right, and I think that maybe is part of the answer to your question. If you're, as you say, you don't have to find everything on a subject to know that something's there, and then once you know that there's a story to tell, you can be a little more free in just exploring and seeing, well, what are those stories, and know that you're not going to be the last person to have a word on this topic. So at some point I had to kind of liberating to say, I am not going to be able to include every interesting aspect of these stories, but I know that I'm going to come out of this with a really good book that's going to be original and either bring together things that very few people knew about in individual cases in a more coherent way, or introduce for the first time many of these stories and sources. There are going to be those, as you know, who say, come on, what does this have to do with, you know, the four-year plan? And I'll say, well, maybe this doesn't have a lot to do with the four-year plan. But, you know, that kind of tension I'm fine with dealing with after realizing how important all of this information is, right? There's a kind of confidence you build, as you suggest, that the story is worth telling. And, you know, you may never get the balance perfect, but I feel, I guess it was less and less daunting as I went on because I was more and more certain that the outcome would be productive.
Right. And there are lots of other things to know about a society and about an ideology, and particularly one that's had an impact on the world such as National Socialism has had. There are lots of other things to know besides the four-year plan, I think. Not that the four-year plan isn't important, but that there are many other things to know. So tell us, I think we kind of have to start, you know, wrapping it up because we've spent a lot of time, you know, and we've taken a lot of your time is what I mean to say. But do tell us before, I want to ask you what you're working on next. But before we do that, tell us, what was the one story that you found that you thought, no way?
What was the one story that I found? No way. I think to come back to what I alluded to before, the incredible interest, the everyday. So to give you one example, for 4 years, very little happened in the Third Reich in regard to fighting against occultism, right? And then in 1937, you start to see some movement based on a low-level debunker named Karl Peltz, okay? Mm-hmm. And this will get to the story I want to tell here, the magician's controversy. We'll end with that. And Karl Peltz had been a debunker for many years, and he was a member of the Nazi Party. He had a friend, a guy named Stadthagen, who also was a debunker. I think he was a chemist. He was not a Nazi. And he said, you know, these occultists are getting away with murder. Why aren't you doing anything about it? And Reinhard Heydrich, was the only SS guy who seemed to really care. So when he got this report, he said, come on, we've got to start doing something about this. And you gradually get some laws between 37 and 38 that start to crack down on occultism. And what's fascinating is by 39 or 40, these debunkers, there's only a handful of them, are getting more and more requests to perform their debunking act in front of larger and larger groups. And what they would do is they'd do a bunch of magic tricks, clairvoyance, spiritualism, seeming to, you know, transport themselves across the room, what have you. And then they take a break and explain the act to larger and larger groups of people, sometimes even the military. The Strength Through Joy movement, right? The Strength Through Joy movement was a way of getting workers and people who didn't have a lot of money, entertainment or a short vacation under Robert Ley and the German labor front. They're hiring these debunkers, right? And in 1940, this group called the Reich Magicians Association comes in, says, we don't like the fact that these debunkers are going out there. They're ruining our act, right? Because they're explaining all our magic tricks. You've got now the SS, the SD, Himmler, Heydrich, Robert Ley and the labor front, Alfred Rosenberg, Hess are all involved in this debate. Well, what do? They're undermining these professional magicians. Now, the professional magicians are obviously occultists. What's so interesting is, one, they're not really angry about the debunking. They're angry because they've become competitors, officially financed by the Reich, in competing for an audience, right? The debunkers agree for a few months, okay, we're going to try not to reveal all these different tricks, and we're going to keep it just to mainstream occultism, which, of course, is impossible because that's what the magicians did. Finally, the leader of the Magicians Association, Helmut Schreiber, who's apparently friendly with Hitler, goes to the Fuhrer and says, this is really unfair. You know, these guys are ruining our act. We depend on magic. We'd like something done. Remember, this is after the Third Reich's supposed to be going after these occultists.
Right.
Hitler asked the Gestapo to prevent the debunkers from performing anymore. The Gestapo, they write all these letters. Come on, I thought we were against superstition and occultism. They are not allowed to perform their act. And then in May of 41, Bormann, who, like Heydrich, is really frustrated with occultism, writes a circular saying, come on, we've got to stop this magic superstition. Everyone, the war, it's proliferating. Germans are reading going to tarot readers that are supposed to be banned. And then 3 days after that, Rudolf Hess, deputy for Fuhrer, flees to Scotland, supposedly on the advice of his astrologer, because he was very much into this stuff. And everyone thinks, okay, finally now we're going to crack down on these guys. And what happens, as I show in the book, the Hess action lasts a few weeks, and within months of that, Himmler, the German Navy, all these other people are hiring these very same occultists to conduct, to look for Mussolini, to find British destroyers that are attacking their U-boats, to give them advice, to create propaganda for the Reich propaganda ministry. So at the end of the day, what this magician's controversy shows for me, which seems like this minor thing among debunkers and performers, is how much the Third Reich from top to bottom was so immersed in this kind of thinking and so unwilling to wipe it out that given the impetus twice, all they ended up doing was going against the debunkers. They're the ones who got the ban.
Yeah, it's a great story. I remember the story from your book, and it's a great story. It's fantastic. It's a fantastic book. Just to remind everyone, we're talking with Eric Courlander about Hitler's Monsters, A Supernatural History of the Third Reich. Eric, we've taken so much of your time. I wonder if you'd just let us have one more question, which is, and now I'm really curious. I would be curious about what you're working on anyway, but in light of your comments, since there's so much stuff in the archives, I'm wondering if you're thinking about writing a second volume on a similar topic or a related one. What are you working on next?
Well, I would love to. I mean, I'm really still very interested in this topic, but I try to transition to different projects. You know, I try to take a kind of different angle on my field when I finish one project, maybe because I spent so much time with it. So maybe I'll come back to the supernatural. But for now, I'm writing a co-written global history of Germany from 1500 to the present. We have a contract with Oxford University Press, and the idea is to write a kind of narrative text or narrative history that incorporates all the great work we've had over the years in looking at Central Europe as a global or transnational space and not merely a national space, right?
Yeah.
So that's what I'm currently working on, and I do have some idea of what I want to do for my next monograph, but we could leave that for another time.
What a great thing, and I'm sure many people who teach German history in the colleges and universities of the United States will be very thrilled to have access to your book. It sounds like a great project and one that will be, you know, very, very useful and very welcome by a lot of teaching faculty. One more thing I wanted to ask, and now I can't remember what it was. Well, we'll talk about it some other time. Eric Correlander, it has been a absolute delight to hear you talk about your wonderful book. Once again, the book is Hitler's Monsters, A Supernatural History of the Third Reich, Yale University Press, 2017, hot off the presses. Eric, thanks so much for your time, and I look forward to reading the next big doorstop you produce.
Thank you so much, Monica. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you did as well.
I sure did. Thanks, Eric. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.